Hello, I'm Emma Desi, and welcome to another episode of Turning Readers into Writers. If you're brand new here, welcome, and here's what you need to know. This is a community that believes you are never too old to write your first novel. No matter what you've been up to until now, if you're ready to write your book, I'm ready to help you reach the end. I focus on helping you find the time and confidence to begin your writing journey, as well as the craft and skills you need to finish the book. Each week I interview debut authors, editors and industry experts to keep you motivated, inspired and educated on all things writing, editing and publishing. If you want to catch up, head on over to emmadesi.com where you'll find a wealth of information and tools to help you get started. Before we dive in, this week's episode is brought to you by my Patreon page over at patreon.com. For supporting the production costs of the podcast each month, you'll receive additional conversations with each week's guest, you'll receive a personal thank you from me, and of course, a shout out on the show. It's an exclusive community of writers who, for only $3 a month, want to support the show and ensure it continues. If you'd like access to additional material and a shout out on the show, go to patreon.com/EmmaDesi. So come on over to patreon.com/EmmaDesi, where I'll be waiting to welcome you into the family. Okay, let's dive in to today's episode. Henry Ball describes himself as an executive, contractor, author and general ruffian. They call him Daddy-O at home. Henry was born and raised in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's the product of a broken home and a dysfunctional family. And Henry learned resilience, ingenuity and a relentless work ethic from his indefatigable mother, Dolores Boone. She helped Henry face the adversities of his tumultuous upbringing at the hands of a violent and abusive father, who Henry decided was not the model for him. Dolores is the inspiration and main character of Henry's debut novel, Sister of Sorrows. His own journey from that tumultuous and debilitating childhood to personal transformation, faith and success is chronicled in the sequel, Sons of Sorrow. Listen to Henry today and find out how he can inspire you to write your debut novel. Well, Henry, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really thrilled to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
I wonder if you could start off by just telling us a little bit about you and how you became a writer.
So I have followed a career path in the construction industry and in doing various, various things in the construction industry, and have risen up as an executive. I have run my own business. I'm currently the vice president of a mid-sized construction company here in the Atlanta area. And I have always, I also went to the Art Institute of Atlanta for, marketing, ad design and things of those that nature. But I never really followed that career path. However, in my career path, I have always been the person who wrote, the marketing, I call it propaganda, but, the marketing commercials and brochures and things of that nature. And I've always been relied on to write, important documents for, the companies I'm involved with. And I've just always been I've always had a pretty good flair for writing. I then started writing for a sports blog, maybe about 15, 18 years ago, called the Bleacher Report. And it's like one of the biggest things on the planet now, but I was actually one of the first writers and one of the first syndicated columnists with the Bleacher Report. They actually offered me a paid position, but it wasn't close enough to what I was earning to feed my family, so I wasn't really able to take it at that time. But I did get a good introduction into the writing world, and I covered my favorite sports team, which is the LSU Tigers. covered a number of football games and went to football games and worked in the press box and things like that. So it was very exciting experience for me. I enjoyed it very much, and had always felt like, you know, I want to write a book. In fact, because of my upbringing, which, you know, is, you know, chronicled in Sister of Sorrows to some degree, I had always kind of thought that the title of my book would be You Can't Get There From Here, because, you know, I really, in a lot of the things that I learned from my mother, I really was able to kind of transform my life as a young man and move away from the childhood that, you know, in my upbringing, and learn to become a successful businessman and a you know, good husband, a good son, a good father, and all of those things. And I, you know, most people I think that come up in the same way and same circumstances, including some of my siblings, have been very successful, and some of my siblings have struggled, you know, because of, you know, because of some of the things that we experienced, you know, as younger people. And so I just kind of always thought that that would be the first book I would write. There's a story that, you know, I can tell you a little bit later about how Sister of Sorrows came about. But once that book actually started being written, it really wasn't so much about me. It was about my mother, and her journey and her struggle and, you know, the adversities that she faced. There was a, you know, the thing that happened within our family that kind of led me or motivated me to, okay, I got to go ahead and write this down. and in fact, and I didn't mention this when I mentioned the Bleacher Report, but I've written other articles for trade magazines, and you know, I've been published in, you know, magazines and things of that nature. Nothing, you know, nothing huge or major, but I've been published a few times. And so I started to write an article, which turned into, you know, the book. And so I guess I'll just tell you that story real quick, just a brief version of it. So one of the things that the book is about is that my mother had another child that we never knew about. In fact, I'm the youngest of six. So I grew up in a household of six children. Well, we come to find out when I was 42 years old, I think 42 or 43, my mother kind of finally, you know, told her deep, dark secret, which is that she placed a child for adoption who would have been the middle child. So I was like, wait a minute, you know, there's some things here that I need to know. There's a story here that I need to know. And a long story short, you know, my mother was forthcoming about, you know, the fact that, you know, she had this child. I actually reached out to and found my sister. My other sister, my oldest sister, now lives with her together in Seattle, Washington. They're like, they've been, you know, together their whole life. But so she's a part of our family now. And she should have been for much longer, because she reached out to my mother back in like 1992, when I was 22 years old. And they had a relationship for, you know, like 18 years, writing cards and letters to each other and talking to each other. And she wanted to know her siblings very badly, but my mother kind of made her promise that she wouldn't tell us, that she would let my mother tell us herself. And she kept saying, well, I've got to get all my kids together, which was kind of a pipe dream. I mean, we're all over the country, so we weren't really going to be in the same room. And by the way, we're all fully grown. So I was like, Mom, you know, why didn't you tell us this way back when, you know? And so then the other issue was that my sister wanted to know about her father, because her father is not my father. Her father, you know, was a different person, which is kind of part of the story. But my mother wouldn't really tell us much about him, other than he came from a powerful family, and she was scared that, it would be, you know, that they would try to protect, you know, him and his legacy or whatever. And so I, you know, I kind of, you know, jokingly asked my mom, "Mom, who did you sleep with? John F. Kennedy? I mean, you know, you don't want us to know this deep, dark secret, but, you know, we need to. We're adults." Well, then come to find out, the gentleman passed away like 30 years ago. And, you know, it was really just this thing in my mom's head that from back then, his family had a little, you know, his family was rich and, you know, powerful in the, you know, in the Baton Rouge area. So to her, he was some big, powerful man that they would try to protect. But she didn't really tell us all of this at the time. And so I just, you know, just made contact with my long lost sister, you know, found out that my mother, who's been keeping this secret for, you know, 45 years now, or almost 50 years, is still not willing to open up about certain aspects of it. So, and then the other element is that, you know, with the adoption of my sister, I had been through the adoption process. My wife and I had a 6-year-old that we adopted, but we had been through like some really, you know, harrowing experiences trying to adopt. We had gone through 5 years, 3 matched adoptions that fell through, and, you know, just some real heartbreaking stuff. And you know, I can tell you the story about my son at another time, but, you know, he's kind of our miracle, you know, at the end of that process. And so I was going to write an article about adoption with my sister, my experience, so on and so forth. But I started with my mother's experience all the way back with my first sister. My mother had gotten pregnant in high school. She was 16 when she got pregnant. She was 17 when she had my sister. This was back in 1957, when it was not acceptable. She was going to be the valedictorian of her class, but she literally had to drop out of high school 6 weeks before graduation because of the pregnancy. And so that really shaped, you know, a lot of her life, and a lot of her potential was blunted because of that. And so that's really where Sister of Sorrows starts, but then goes through kind of a, you know, like, you know, the somewhat remarkable history of our family. And I personally think it's turned into a very, as you would say, lovely book and a lovely story. And so that's kind of where my writing came from. Now, I have also written, not quite ready to publish, the sequel to Sister of Sorrows, which is Sons of Sorrow, which is really my story. It kind of picks up where Sister of Sorrows left off with, you know, me as a teenager, and then kind of, you know, goes through my journey, you know, through my childhood and to adulthood and kind of a coming of age, and then the transformation of my life, and you know, kind of brings us to where we are today.
It's an amazing story. I thought for a second you were going to say that it was JFK.
Well, so you have to read the book. The person is not. So it's a fictional memoir, right? And so. The names of, you know, the lay people, my family, you know, most people involved have been changed. You know, I say to protect the innocent, and some were guilty too. But there are some public figures in the book whose names haven't been changed. Like for one, Billy Cannon, who was a very famous football player back in the 50s and 60s. A hero to the state of Louisiana, and a friend of my father's. He, several years after his football career, when he was a successful orthodontist in Baton Rouge, and just an absolute hero to the whole state of Louisiana, became embroiled and was the ringleader of the largest counterfeiting scheme in the history of the country. And my father was an unindicted co-conspirator, if you will, in that counterfeiting scheme. The counterfeiting scheme itself and Mr. Cannon is, you know, public record. But my dad's involvement, my dad was the one person that wasn't indicted and wasn't, you know, prosecuted, because nobody really knew much about his involvement other than Mr. Cannon and my father. So I kind of go into the details of that. But one of the things about Mr. Cannon is, you know, he was, when the counterfeiting scheme happened, Sports Illustrated ran an article and called him a counterfeit hero. And he lost, you know, he had won the Heisman Trophy back in 1958. So they took away the Heisman Trophy. He was removed from the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was removed, you know, from the College Hall of Fame. So, I mean, this man, you know, was at the absolute pinnacle of, you know, of sports and, you know, heroism and, you know, celebrity. And he fell, you know, to the absolute bottom, went to prison. And then he, you know, he made the long journey back to respectability. And shortly before my father's death, ESPN ran a program on Outside the Lines called The Redemption of Billy Cannon. And you know, so it kind of showed how he had, you know, faced the music and paid the price for his mistakes and had really climbed back to respectability. And by the time he passed away, I think a little more than a year ago, or year and a half, something like that, but he had regained his status really as, you know, one of the great heroes of the state of Louisiana. And so, you know, the book kind of goes through that. But there was also a huge impact on our family. This all happened when I was, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. And these things also took place when we lived in Louisiana through some of the, you know, greatest flooding and storms, you know, in the state's history. And so, you know, part of the book and part of that time in my life was how our entire life really got washed away. Our home was flooded literally up to the ceilings and had to be gutted and rebuilt. And we walked on concrete floors for 2.5 years because that's how long it took to actually rebuild our house after this flood. And we lost everything. I mean, I lost most of my clothes and, you know, I had one pair of shoes for, you know, most of my childhood and they were two sizes too small for me. And so, you know, we kind of lost everything in that sense, but we also lost everything in the sense that my dad really lost himself. I mean, he became a very violent alcoholic and, you know, unlike Mr. Cannon, unlike Billy Cannon, he never really climbed back to respectability. He never really made it out. And I hate that. I mean, as his son, I loved my father and I, you know, and I tried to be a good son as I grew up, but he left behind a pretty bad legacy. And the one thing that you'll take from my book, and it's one thing that has really guided me in my life, I've always used my father as an example of what not to be or an example of who not to be. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of sad that that's the best thing that I can say about my dad, but it's left with me the determination that I will never be like that. And my 6-year-old son will always grow up knowing that he had a father who really loved him and who was there for him no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, it's strange how good comes from adversity, mm-hmm. but that's, you know, that's how, you know, good came from that situation.
Yeah. So it's fascinating, both stories. I'm really looking forward to reading them. Did you find then that, because you've mentioned that they're sort of fictionalized memoir, creative nonfiction, did you find writing these quite cathartic? Was it a way of kind of therapeutic almost, that you're able to kind of write all this down, get it all out, and let go of it, I suppose?
Well, so that is kind of, in fact, what it became. That wasn't, you know, I didn't really go into it, you know, thinking that way. Uh-huh. And really when I started writing it and, you know, you had to, there's certain things I knew, but I had to, you know, kind of go back and do a little research to make sure I had the, you know, times and dates and, you know, things right. And I talked to my sister a lot, who's 13 years older than me and has, you know, had a more adult memory of that time of our life. So she was able to help me kind of, you know, put things into, you know, perspective. But it really did do that. It made me remember a lot of stuff that I had long since forgotten and wanted to forget. Mm-hmm. But it helped me to deal with those things in a better way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're not just forgotten. They're processed. Mm-hmm. It was definitely a very good exercise for me in that way. What's funny is my sister, my older sister, the one, as I said, say that was 13 years older than me, is a bit of a writer herself. And she has more, you know, training and education in that field, though she has worked in, you know, more of the administrative field herself and, you know, executive administration. But she has, you know, some projects that she's worked on over time. And what I didn't realize is that she was kind of trained in editing. And I asked her, my book design company, you know, has a professional editor that's edited, you know, done the final copy edit, but they wanted me to do it myself as well. And said, if you can enlist anyone else, you know, it's better to have, you know, multiple eyes on it. So I sent a copy to my sister, and like, she is as good as the copy editor. And I was like, wow, I didn't know you were that good. And she's helped me with some stylistic things, but I had a conversation with her yesterday and she said, I can't tell you how joyful, but hard it has been reading this book. And she said she was crying. She was, you know, reading it and crying. And my other sister asked her, like, why are you crying? And she said, because I know these people, because this is me. And these are, you know, this is us. And my other sister, Lori, said, well, you can't read the book anymore. And she goes, well, I have to. I've got to finish it. I've got to finish the edit. And so she said it was good and productive for her as well.
Yeah.
But
it's interesting because that's quite often why we read fiction is sometimes we want to read about a life that's completely different to ours, but somewhere in there we want to read something that reflects our life back to us or reflects a life that we perhaps wish that we had or personalities that we wish we had. And so to literally,
I haven't gotten to that yet. I haven't written about that yet, but I will.
But yeah, so now she's kind of literally seeing it. It's no wonder it's impacting her so much. So you mentioned there the company, the editing company you used. So for those who are listening and might be getting towards the end of writing their final draft, so they've done as much as they can by themselves, what would be, or what's been your experience, and what would you suggest others try to get them from that finished draft right through to a published manuscript?
So two things that I did. I have my newfound sister, Lori, had a good friend of hers, Elsie Olison, who has unfortunately passed away. But she recommended that I contact Elsie and, you know, discuss the book with her and that she might be able to help me with, you know, developmental editing and things of that nature. And she really served as more of a book coach to me. And I think that was part of her background. She introduced me to both Lisa Tenner and Stuart Horowitz. And Stuart Horowitz actually wound up doing the developmental edit. And I would say that, first of all, that this is a compliment to his talents and him as an individual. But he really helped me shape the book into, you know, not just a, you know, fictional memoir, but a really good story. And he really helped me to kind of develop that story and to understand how to, you know, how to follow the process. He's written several books, including, you know, several best-selling books on how to write best-selling books. So he knows what he's talking about. But then he recommended for the book design company, 1106 Design, Michelle DeFilippo. And they have been, you know, just phenomenal. And they took the, you know, we talked about the cover earlier. I had some personal artwork done, which was actual, you know, an incredibly talented artist took a picture of my mother and, you know, created a book cover out of her image, which was wonderful. But it wasn't really, it wasn't right for the cover. And, but so I sent all of that to 1106. They, you know, they read the book. They, you know, they talked to me about what I wanted to accomplish. And, you know, they went through their process with all their questioning. And then they came back with several concepts, including the one that and it was a hard decision because there were two concepts that were just, you know, just knocked it out of the park. Perfect. But one, which is the current cover, which is the, you know, the lady in the silhouette with the, you know, the swamp scene inside the silhouette, just has a very intriguing look and just perfect for the book cover. And I think, so they really, to me, they just really hit a home run. And everything that I have done with them, including the book trailer that's going to be coming out really soon, I was a little nervous about that because the original script that was sent to me, I thought, well, it's nice, but I don't know, you know, I don't know how captivating it would be, how it's going to, you know, really attract people. And then just a couple of days ago, the producer, we did a Zoom call and he, you know, he played the, you know, the draft of the trailer for me. And I'm like, oh, wow. You know, it's like a Hollywood production. It's awesome. And I can't wait. You know, I can't wait for it to get out there. So I can't speak highly enough for, you know, for Stuart Horowitz and Michelle DeFilippo and her team at 1106. They've really helped me take, you know, take my writing and take the book and make it a very professionally done production that hopefully will be successful. But I will be very proud of it regardless of you know, how well it does.
Yay. And so. I'll link to these guys in the show notes so anyone else can go and have a look at them. I just want to take you back to the editing process. Mm-hmm. It was a developmental structural edit that they did. Is that right?
That was the first edit with Stuart Horowitz, correct.
And I wonder if you could just share with us maybe one or two things that you, in particular, that you took away from that, or when the penny dropped and you thought, ah, okay, I see how that's done.
Well, I think, he basically took my draft and we talked through things and he sent me different questionnaires and, you know, how did this occur? What do you think about this? And so we kind of went through this process of him really just, I think, internalizing the story. And then he showed me, and then he took the first couple of chapters and he did his developmental edit to it. And then we talked that through and he showed me how to really develop characters and how to, you know, I mean, I feel like I do a pretty good job with describing scenes and putting, you know, placing people to where they can kind of see what's happening, you know, with their own eyes. And I try to do the same thing with character development, you know, so that people can, you know, imagine that person, what that person looks like and what, you know, what kind of character that person has and what kind of character that person is. And Stuart really helped me take that to the next level. I mean, he is really, to me, very talented in getting to the core. Like he taught, I hate to say this, and I hope I don't mess up the word, but you know, I've always had a fairly good and fairly large vocabulary. But in describing my mother, you know, my mother was a tireless worker. She worked, you know, night and day to support her children because she really didn't have support from her, you know, her two husbands, you know, two at separate times, two husbands. And really she was, you know, she was on her own to, you know, feed and clothe and house, you know, six kids. And so she was a tireless, you know, worker and just had the greatest work ethic. And so his description of her, you know, person, mother, you know, so he kind of taught me a new word and it just perfectly fits because my mother was tireless. My mm-hmm. mother was, you know, a very hard worker and she taught me a strong work ethic really by example. I mean, she, you know, preached, you know, to work hard and, you know, do things the right way and, you know, to always be honest and courteous, but never get outworked. And she was very much, you know, she was very much that way herself. And she taught her kids to be that way. And for the most part, we all are. And that has been probably the biggest key to most of our success. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he really helped me to not just, I mean, I didn't have to develop my mother's character. I knew my mother's character. He helped me to express it, if right. you will, okay. in such a way that others can also appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Well, just to kind of, I want to just change tack slightly and ask you a little bit more about the kind of practicalities of writing, because I know you've said you're pretty high up in the construction industry within the firm that you work. So I imagine there's long hours involved there. So, and you've mentioned you've got a young son, still young. I have a 6-year-old boy myself, so I know exactly what that's like. So how do you find the time to balance work, family, and then writing as well?
So that is very difficult and has become much more difficult with my son being in the picture. Most of the writing for Sons of Sorrows and Sister of Sorrows actually took place shortly before, you know, the adoption of our son. But I also have like 4 other book projects or 5 other book projects that I'm working on. And I would say those are moving slower than Sons of Sorrows and Sister of Sorrows did when I originally wrote them. You know, I am making the time for, you know, this process with the publishing of Sister of Sorrows. And I also have a pretty good business book that's going to be, you know, kind of coming out fairly soon. And we're working on the concept with that. My business partner and the owner of the construction company that I'm with is very supportive and actually my partner in our publishing company, which is Storied Press. And so he's, you know, he's supportive of my efforts in my writing. Having said that, you know, our day to day doesn't allow for a lot of, you know, just, you know, solace and, you know, writing time and, you know, kind of getting together with my thoughts. You know, I don't have a lot of time for that. So what winds up happening is, you know, I've got these, you know, book projects and you know, sometime in the morning, sometimes in the evening and, you know, on the weekends, I'll spend a little bit of time writing a chapter or, you know, writing a few pages. I lamentably, and I don't want to encourage this for any of your readers or viewers, but I don't have a daily word count. I don't have a daily amount that I try to put down, though I would like to do that and like to get to that. But I would say right now, you know, I average maybe 5 or 6 hours a week altogether in strictly writing. I spend more time in some of the other things, marketing and you know, going through the design stuff with 1106. I've just finished combining their proofread edits from their editor with my edits. And the last step is going through my sister's edits and kind of making those changes. The good thing is that her and the editor from 1106 are almost 100% in agreement with all of the punctuation and, you know, structural edits. But what she has added that he really can't add is some real style and real, you know, kind of understanding of the subject matter. And so there's a few things that she's, you know, helped me to, you know, really improve on. And so I probably got a couple of more days of finishing that up. And really then the book will be ready to publish. The design is already approved. The cover's approved. The back cover things are being worked on. And our intention is for a, you know, early December release. So that it, you know, is on the market during December and mm-hmm. moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I feel comfortable that we'll be able to hit that. So for the next few weeks will be very, you know, very busy and very important.
Uh-huh. So you mentioned that you get about 5 hours a week of writing time done. That's a lot. That's great. Do you find that you say schedule that in ahead of time, so you know you've got that time allocated, or is it kind of as and when?
Yeah, it's scheduled in that there's a few windows that I intend to be my writing windows. Mm. But like you said, you know, with a 6-year-old, you know, and family, we've got 3 dogs and you know, I've got all kinds of business things that I'm always dealing with. And, you know, the one thing about construction, I say this, and I hope that some of the people that work with me don't see it and be offended by it, because I mean it very lovingly, but a lot of what I do is babysitting. you know, you have to make sure that, you know, the contractors and subcontractors are where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be, and they, you know, do certain things the right way. And, you know, so you're always dealing with, you know, issues that people are facing in the field. And and so I call myself, you know, a babysitter for the most part. I think I'm fairly good at that. And it's just part of what I do every day and who I am every day. So I don't really consider that as, you know, scheduled time. So my scheduled time sometimes gets interrupted by that, or my child wants to play tag. And you kind of got to play tag when you got to play tag. So it doesn't always happen, but I try.
And so when you do get those writing slots, when you do get to your desk, are you someone who, even though I know your first book is sort of part memoir, do you plot it out in advance or make notes about what you're going to write about next? Or are you very much a discovery writer and you sit down and what comes?
So I was very much a discovery writer in Sister of Sorrows. But part of the process that Stuart, you know, helped me was to outline and structure. And so Sons of Sorrows was still more of a discovery process because it was really Sons of Sorrows and Sister of Sorrows got written together. And at one point it was just one book. And, you know, we decided that, you know, it really should be 2 books. And so we kind of picked the place that the 2 books would diverge, and it became 2 books. But everything that I have done since then has been with an outline and then kind of developing that outline and has been more structural. And I think it's improved my writing because of it.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. You've liked having a bit more structure there to work within.
I do. I mean, there's still a lot of, you know, the creativity process, and, you know, even in the outline, you know, you're still, you know, there's still a creative process that puts that outline together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always an amount of discovery writing involved, but the more structural part of it allows me to develop the characters better and to develop the scenes better and to, I think, you know, really kind of, you know, create a universe, you know, that you're working within and develop that universe. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that has, you know, been a big improvement. I feel like Sister of Sorrows happened the way it happened because that's, you know, that's what had to happen.
Yes.
And it, you know, and I think it probably benefited from just being discovery writing.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, there was never really an outline for it, but the outline for it was really my life, right? The outline was my experience and, you know, kind of putting those into a storied format. And so, you know, the outline was really there already for that. But what I've done since then, I feel like has improved my writing.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. Yeah. I'm a discovery writer and I keep trying to move more towards plotting and planning. I struggle with it, but I'm keeping on with it because I've been told, you know, it can speed up the process. So I'm kind of all for that. Now, I am just conscious of time. So I wanted to ask you just a couple more things, one of which is, in terms of the craft of writing, is there anyone in particular that you turn to or any books that you've read or any courses you've done or anything like that that you found beneficial and or worth our listeners checking out?
So two things. You know, one thing about my mother is my mother was an insatiable and avid reader. She had, you know, she literally had a library that was just a wall of novels, and she had read every one of them at least twice. And I kind of got this from her. She'd start reading a book, and she, you know, she wouldn't sleep or do anything else until she finished that book. And she would read, you know, she would read a 400, 500 page novel in less than a day and a half. I mean, she was a reader. And I am not to that level, but when I start reading a book, I get engrossed in it and I, you know, I don't put it down until I'm finished. And one of the people that I just absolutely love, and this is going to sound kind of cliche and, you know, it sounds like, you know, anybody, because everybody knows who he is, would say this, but I just love his writing style, is John Grisham. And I have read just about every one of his books. And I love that. I love that suspense and kind of real life legalese that he brings into his books. And so as a, you know, writers that inspire me, I love John Grisham. I love Clancy. You know, I love those kind of books. But I also love the fictional history type books. I mentioned earlier Billy Cannon. I just got through reading the book about him, A Long, Long Run. I thought it was a great book. It was awesome. And I couldn't put it down. I read it in a couple of days. And so those are the kind of things that I would say influence me from a writer to writer perspective. Now, I think I want to say, you and I connected on Alessandra Torre's Facebook group. She is awesome. She has a class for using Goodreads, and any writer, any of your writers who want to become published authors and expect to, you know, succeed, need to do her class on Goodreads. It only takes about an hour. There's other materials that you can, you know, then access. But it's a very, you know, very good hour and really helps you to appreciate how to use Goodreads to, you know, to promote yourself and to, you know, to kind of move forward. So that's been great. There's a bunch of other Facebook groups like hers, but I think for me, hers has been, you know, one of the most effective. And then, as I mentioned already, you know, Stuart Horowitz and 1160 Design. If you get to the point where you want to work with, you know, professionals on finishing your book and getting it ready for publish, they are absolutely, you know, highly recommended by me. Absolutely. And also, and just one last thing, I don't want to not mention this, Lisa Tenner, who is also a book coach, also has a group similar to Alessandra Torre's. She is absolutely awesome. And so I, you know, I recommend, you know, I recommend her as well.
Okay, excellent. I'll find that and link to that. So I guess the last question would be, you know, Sister of Sorrows is out soon. Do you have a release date yet?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a release date yet for Sister
of Sorrows? No, we will probably finalize the release date in the next, I would say, in the next week to 10 days. I'm shooting for the first week of December.
And where can listeners connect with you on social media if they want to stay in touch?
So Facebook, you know, it's just my name, Henry Ball, on Facebook. And then also you could go to www.sisterofsorrows.com.
Lovely. Fantastic. Well, Henry, it's been a delight talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I hope you got a lot out of that conversation with Henry. I know I certainly did. One of my biggest takeaways from him was when you have a passion for something, you will find the time to do it. So although he has a busy job and many other interests outside of work, he still found the time to write the book, do the research, get it edited, find a great editor who really helped him to shape the story of the book, find a great production company who helped him with the design of the book and the book cover, and then, of course, putting together a book trailer, which you'll see if you go to the blog post associated with this interview. One of the other things I took away from my conversation with Henry was how often a great story is right there in front of us. So his own upbringing, the story of his mum, was the basis of his novel Sister of Sorrows, and indeed the sequel that he's currently writing, Son of Sorrows. So sometimes, you know, life is stranger than fiction. And perhaps your story, your next story, is right there in front of you. You just have to take a little look around to see the magic. Well, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you have enjoyed the show, please don't forget to leave a review wherever it is that you listen to your podcasts. Reviews, as you know, help other people to find the show and help it to grow. All right, take care for now, and I'll see you soon.